We're here with the distinguished professor, Vikram Amar. He's a former dean of the University of Illinois College of Law, my alma mater, and distinguished professor of law at University of California, Davis School of Law, a Yale law grad. He clerked for Justice Harry Blackmun. And my understanding is that he is the first person of South Asian heritage to clerk for the U.S. Supreme Court. Welcome to the show, Professor. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you for having me. And that, by the way, was a bizarre song you played.
Yes, there's more to it than that. Yes. I would say the singing is not so great, but it's kind of fun to watch. Okay, so tell us, what is birthright citizenship and why should we care about it?
So birthright citizenship is the concept that is, at least under conventional understanding, embodied in the 14th Amendment of the Constitution and also in separately in federal statutes that says if you're born in the United States, regardless of who your parents are and where they are citizens are of and how they got to be in the United States, if you're born in the United States, you are a citizen of the United States, unless you are born to foreign diplomats who are have immunity from federal law. So anytime you're born in the United States in a situation where the United States has dominion over you, you are a U.S. citizen. And that's important because that distinguishes the United States from some other countries that determine citizenship not based on place or location, but instead based on the bloodlines, the lineage of the parents. So the United States is one of maybe three dozen countries in the world that base citizenship on location, the law of the soil, rather than the law of the blood, which would turn on who your parents are and what their relationship to the place that you were born is. In the United States, so even if we don't know who your parents are, if you're a foundling, if we just find a baby and we know it was born somewhere in the United States, that person is a citizen regardless of the parents because the parents are irrelevant under the birthright citizenship concept.
How entrenched is this? I mean, give us an idea year-wise and case precedent without talking about case precedents and citations and all of that stuff. But, I mean, this has not really been questioned, really, in the past, has it?
No, it went back to the middle of the 19th century, beginning in the early 1800s. And citizenship back then wasn't really as much of a formal legal concept in the United States because we didn't really have immigration laws and the like. People just came here and they made their lives here. But certainly by the time of the 14th Amendment in 1868, there was this pretty settled understanding that just as you were a British subject, if you were born anywhere within the British Empire, so too you are an American citizen if you're born anywhere in the United States, except those places that were not within U.S. control or dominion. So, for example, if you were born on an Indian reservation, which was considered kind of a separate country, and the U.S. didn't exert dominion over the territory of Indian reservations or Indian nations, then you wouldn't be a citizen. So, too, you wouldn't be a citizen if you were born in enemy-controlled territory, if the United States was in a war and the British were controlling parts of Maine or the French were controlling parts of Northern America, you wouldn't be a citizen if you were born in that territory that was being controlled by a foreign power at that time. And as I mentioned earlier, if you were born in a foreign embassy, for example, that would not be a place where the United States exercised dominion. But putting aside these very tiny locational exceptions, anyone born within the United States is a citizen, and that was the concept that was essentially kind of rolled over into or incorporated into the 14th Amendment, under conventional understanding at least.
So let's just be practical, and let's just say that the Supreme Court agrees with President Trump and that it is constitutional to bar or ban birthright citizenship. As a practical matter, how does this work? Does it make it hard? I mean, I assume it makes it harder for people to prove they're a citizen because, what, they're going to have to show that one of their parents has a birth certificate from showing that they're a citizen?
Or showing that they were naturalized,
right,
or they were a permanent resident alien. So what the Trump executive order says in broad brush terms is, even if you're born in the United States, you're not a citizen unless at least one of your parents was here at the time of your birth, and he or she was a citizen or a permanent resident alien. So if both your parents were here temporarily as visitors, or even for, say, a five-year student visa or a five-year scientific visa, a scientific kind of research visa, you wouldn't be a citizen even if you were born here. Or more powerfully, if both your parents were here unlawfully, if they entered the country illegally or they had overstayed their status by the time of your birth, then you also wouldn't be a citizen. So, yes. So one practical problem with the Trump executive order's approach is that it requires complicated questions about proving who your parents were, and that's one of the issues that it raises. There's a bigger issue, though, and that is while the executive order purports to apply this new approach only going forward, only in the future, only prospectively to children who are not yet born in the United States, in theory, there's nothing to stop a future president or a future Congress from saying, well, if Trump was right about what the Constitution means, then we can de-citizenize people who have been born here over the last 50 years or 100 years who thought that they were citizens and whom we treated as citizens, but who don't pass the Trump test. And so it could potentially, when you pull on the string, unravel the citizenship of millions or scores of millions of people who are already here, who take for granted their citizenship, and whose children take for granted their citizenship because it was based on the citizenship of their parents. But if your dad wasn't a citizen because his dad wasn't here lawfully, then neither are you a citizen under the Trump test. So as I say, you pulled the string on this, and there's lots and lots and lots of people who, strictly speaking, wouldn't have an entitlement to citizenship if a subsequent president decided to apply this approach backwardly and not just going forward.
That sounds like massive confusion and chaos. Now, the Supreme Court, you know, if you know and you watch, well, you were a clerk on the Supreme Court, and so you know that during the arguments, you can't always tell what the Supreme Court justices are thinking and saying. They could be playing devil's advocate and asking questions that are meant to influence or persuade maybe their fellow justices. But having watched some of this, these arguments, what do you make of what they might do?
So you're right and smart to point out that oral argument isn't always a good basis for predicting. It turned out to be a good basis for predicting in the tariff case, where the argument really did show the concerns that even conservative justices had about the unbridled tariff power that President Trump asserted. In this particular case, it's not just that the oral argument skepticism of the Trump executive order across the ideological spectrum on the court. It's that, remember, every lower federal court judge, district court judge, court of appeals judge, every one of the judges in the courts below, whether they were Republican appointees or Democratic appointees, every one of them who'd looked at the merits of the Trump executive order were very skeptical about whether this order was consistent with the Constitution and federal statutes. So if I were to make a prediction about the Supreme Court, I would bet very heavily that they will not uphold this executive order, that they will strike it down. Now, I personally tend to think they're likely to strike it down without reaching the 14th Amendment U.S. constitutional question, because as I've adverted to, there's a federal statute passed by Congress in 1940 and again in 1952 that also embodies this conventional notion of birthright citizenship, and the president can't simply unilaterally override a congressional statute. So I think that there'll probably be 7, maybe 8 or 9 justices who will say that the executive order violates the statute, and then how many of them will go on to say, and it also violates the U.S. Constitution, that's a harder thing to guess. I'm sure that the 3 Democratic appointees will say that the Trump executive order violates both the statute and the Constitution, but whether there'll be 5 justices to say it violates the Constitution, I'm not sure, because some of the conservative justices have often said if you can resolve a case under a statute, then you don't reach the constitutional question. So I think, for example, Chief Justice John Roberts will likely take that more incremental approach.
And that would leave it, if that were the case, that the court only struck it based upon the congressional issues, that would leave it for the Congress to maybe make new laws that would affect would then go to the constitutional issue.
That's right.
If I'm saying that right, yeah.
If the court were to, as I think is possible, strike it down under the statute without resolving the constitutional question, that would leave it open to Congress, if it wanted to and had the votes, to revise the current statute, and then that would apply going forward only. And then the court would be confronted in a subsequent case with the constitutional question, and it would have to reach that. I think that push comes to shove, there are 5 votes to say the Constitution guarantees birthright citizenship, even for children born to unlawfully present parents, but there would have to be a separate case to say that.
I want to ask you about something that I think that we're seeing more and more now of, and maybe it's just my perception, but does it seem like the Supreme Court decisions have become more politicized?
Well, I think that is a perception, and certainly the public has less confidence in the Supreme Court than at other times in history, but of course, the public has less confidence in all institutions than it used to. Congress, the president, the media, universities, the organized religion. So the court is still held up a little bit better than other institutions of government. But the Supreme Court sometimes does things that we might consider self-inflicted wounds. I think Bush versus Gore in 2000, where the Supreme Court needlessly interjected itself into the presidential election, was damaging. I think actually the Trump immunity case a few years ago, where the court granted very, very broad immunity to presidents to pretty much do anything they wanted, free from criminal responsibility, that didn't go over very well. But as to your question about whether there's more partisanship, remember Bush versus Gore was a straight party line vote. That was 26 years ago to decide the presidential election. There are major decisions that are decided today that are not party line votes, and I think this birthright citizenship is going to be one such case. It's not going to be based on who appointed the justices. The tariff case was 6-3, with 2 of the 3 justices in the majority being people who President Trump appointed, and they said he didn't have the power to basically do whatever he wanted under the tariffs regime. So I think it's sometimes overstated how much political partisanship matters at all. There might be a few cases where you could make that argument, but in general, I would say no, and I think people need to be a little bit more open-minded about what the court does.
You know, President Obama, I remember when he was getting ready to nominate somebody, or maybe he was just making these comments, he was saying that, you know, it's impossible for a justice or any judge to put aside their prejudices, who they are, where they're raised, their race, religion, their level of their monetary level, their financial situation. And I think we're all a product of our backgrounds and those issues. Is it possible for a justice truly to put aside all prejudices in making these rulings that are so impactful to our society?
Well, that's a big question, and you know, your instinct on that and the listener's instinct on that maybe my mind might not be any better than theirs, but I will say this. I think there is a difference between putting aside your prejudices, which I think we all strive to do based on race or class or religion, but one thing you can't put aside and that you shouldn't put aside is your philosophy, your ideology, your approach to understanding law. Are you someone who cares a lot about the text? Are you someone who cares a lot about history? Those are perfectly appropriate things to take into account. The one thing that's not appropriate, and this is where I think critics of the court sometimes overstate their criticism, is you're not supposed to take into account the partisan identity of the party. So whether it's a president from the Democrats or a president from the Republican Party, the court should address questions the same way. And I think they generally do a pretty good job of not being partisan. Now, whether they are political in the philosophical or ideological sense is different than being partisan in terms of, well, that person's part of my team. I'm team blue or I'm team red. That person's part of my tribe. That is out of bounds. But if you're a conservative and you're appointed because you're a conservative, you're going to reach conservative results. Same is true if you're more on the liberal side. So I don't think that's unexpected or even particularly problematic. But I think it is problematic when we have decisions that seem to distinguish between which party is in power. That's out of bounds.
And I only have a few minutes here. I know this is complicated, but last week the Supreme Court handed down a ruling on the issue of conversion therapy. My understanding is that more than half of the states have enacted laws that ban this kind of therapy. Basically, this is a therapy that's designed to try to change a minor's sexual orientation or gender identity. It's been thought in the medical profession that this is harmful to children, and that's why it has been outlawed. And the court issued an opinion striking down at least a portion of these bans. Can you tell us just in the simplest terms what this ruling means?
Yeah, so first of all, let's point out that the ruling was 8-1 with only Justice Jackson dissenting. So you had eight justices, including Justices Sotomayor and Kagan, along with the six Republican appointees, who voted to invalidate Colorado's ban on conversion therapy on the ground that it violated the First Amendment free expression rights of the therapist to basically give her opinions, because the way the law was written, a therapist could give an opinion in the direction of affirming someone's gender identity. So if you go to a therapist and say, I think I'm gay, what do you think? And the therapist could say, oh, yes, I think you should embrace your gayness. That would be okay for the therapist. But the therapist could not say, well, maybe you're not gay and maybe you want to explore that, or if you want to explore that, I can help you do that. So the court said that it discriminated between certain points of view and other points of view, and that's a no-no under the First Amendment. Now, I think where things get complicated is when we regulate the medical profession generally, we often allow, for example, in malpractice suits, the government to hold you liable based merely on what you might advise or say as a doctor. If you express the view as a doctor that maybe it's worth drinking Clorox to protect yourself from COVID, you're going to be hit up with malpractice. Whereas if you express the view that, no, that's a bad idea, you shouldn't do that, then you're not going to be guilty of malpractice. So one of the things that Justice Gorsuch's opinion had to do, and I think this is the kind of the toughest part of the opinion, is explain why malpractice liability doesn't violate the First Amendment, even when the doctor has done nothing more than talk to the patient, hasn't even done any prescription or any medical procedure, but has just talked to the patient, but talked to them in a way that expressed one point of view that's out of bounds within the medical profession. Why that's okay to attach liability to the doctor there, but not in this setting. And Gorsuch had some answers, but I think it's those answers that really determine how coherent this area of law is going to be going forward.
Yeah, and, you know, it spills into the legal area, because as a lawyer, you know, I mean, as a person, I can tell Matt Moyer sitting here in my studio, you can lie. Go ahead and lie in the stand. I don't care. I think
exactly.
It's a great idea. I like lying personally.
Exactly.
But, you know, and for that, I could get disbarred, and rightly so.
That's
because
exactly right.
Because I'm upholding my oath to be honest and do all the good things that we lawyers do. So anyway, that's one I think we're going to see lots of litigation around, and maybe the fine-tuning some of the points in this opinion. Professor Vikram Amar, please, thank you so much for joining us on this Easter Sunday, and please come back and do the great job you do of explaining these very complicated matters. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, and happy Easter to everybody.
All right, take care.